Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just James Phelps with his big hit, Love is a Five-Letter Word. And if you're just tuning in, I have James Phelps on the phone with me. We had some technical difficulties, but hopefully it will work out now. So, James, can you hear me now?
I can hear you very good.
Okay, great. So let's start all over again. So you weren't born in Chicago, is that right?
No, I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana.
And how old were you when you came to Chicago?
Oh, 17, 18 years old, yes.
And what prompted did your whole family move, or did you move to Chicago yourself? What happened?
No, my older brother lived in Chicago for years, and he sent for me. And my main object was, when I came to Chicago, was to get with the Soul Stirrers.
Okay, so that was your goal, was to come in to do music and to sing with the Soul Stirrers.
Yes.
So were you involved with music before you came to Chicago?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, as long as I can remember, Bob, I've been singing.
How were you first involved with music?
Well, I've always been in quartets, even in Louisiana when I was a teenager.
Okay. What were the names of some of the quartets you sang with in Louisiana?
The Spiritual Five. And Spiritual Five was really the group.
Okay. And did you ever record before you came to Chicago?
No.
Okay. So when you came to Chicago, what year did you come to Chicago?
I came to Chicago in 49.
Okay. And you said your goal was to get with the Soul Stirrers. Were they already together at that point?
Yes. Sam Cooke had just left the Highway QCs and was with the Soul Stirrers, and I said, well, I'm going to make it too.
So you didn't even know any of the guys. You came to Chicago and you're like, I'm going to be in the Soul Stirrers.
Right.
Okay. So what happened when you came to Chicago? Did you start off and join the Soul Stirrers right away?
No, I started out by being a member of Greater Harvest Baptist Church at 51st State, Reverend Body. And I sang in the choir there with Robert Anderson and, and then I had a group by the name of the Holy Wonders, and then the Clefts of Calvary.
So, and those groups, did any of those groups record?
Yes.
Which, did both of those groups record?
The Gospel Songbirds, yes, they recorded, and I did one recording with them, and I did two albums with the Clefts of Calvary.
What's the Gospel Songbirds track that you recorded on?
The Clefts of Calvary. I had the number one, really getting a little ahead of myself, but I had the number one R&B and gospel at the same time. And my big record was Standing Where Jesus Stood.
Do you remember what record label that came out on?
That's True Sound out of Newark, New Jersey.
Okay. Do you remember how you guys got a deal with a New Jersey label, being from Chicago?
Shirley Caesar was the one that introduced me to Ozzy Cadena in Newark.
Okay. And do you remember what year that record came out?
Oh, wow. That had to be in the 60.
Okay. And you said it was a number one record. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Was it number one? Were there like religious stations that charted it? Like how? Like number? What chart was it number one on?
It was number one on the Gospel Hit Parade.
Okay.
Number one. Every, as a matter of fact, on the album Standing, Standing Where Jesus Stood, was every song on there was a hit.
Okay. And so, did your group perform a lot too, and tour, or did you just mainly record?
Well, we did quite a bit. We worked with the Soul Stirrers, and that's how I really got with the Soul Stirrers, because the Clefts of Calvary sound so much like the Soul Stirrers until they had no choice but to get me, because people had started to ask the Soul Stirrers to sing some of the Clefts of Calvary's recordings, because they thought it was the Soul Stirrers.
Okay, so the Soul Stirrers was probably one of your biggest gospel influences, and you always wanted to sing
with
them.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So you said that you were asked to join the Soulsters. So that just happened through knowing them and doing shows with them?
Well, what happened was the main lead singer, Jimmy Outlaw, was out in California, and he couldn't make it, and I went to Detroit with him. And, man, I tell you, we had such a great time. Now, C.L. Franklin picked me up. He said, and he was holding me like I was a baby. He said, well, y'all get this little guy from.
So they were much, were they older than you?
Oh, the Soulsters?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And so you're saying you filled in for them you filled in for one of the members that was in California at a show.
After that, they asked me to join, and Roebuck Staples, we all coming back from Detroit, and Roebuck said to Farley, he says, man, why you guys want to do that? He said, you took Sam from the QCs, now you're taking Phelps from the Clefs of Cavalry.
Okay, so what happened to the Clefs of Cavalry after you left? Did they stay together?
They stayed together for a very short while. I understand Roscoe Robinson, that was used to be with the Five Blind Boys. He was with them. He did a recording with them. And after that, the guys just, you know.
So what was the lineup of the Soulsters at the point that you joined?
Oh, it was Jimmy Outlaw, Leroy Croom, Sonny Mitchell, Gibbs, Richard Gibbs, and Paul Foster had, really and truly, I replaced for Paul Foster.
Okay. So what had happened to Sam Cooke? Did he leave at that point?
Well, Sam Cooke was already out there, and, you know, he had been out there for some time.
Okay, so had you ever sang together with Sam, or did you ever get to work with him?
Yes.
When was that?
We played Madison Square Garden for Christmas, and Sam worked several times on shows with us. As a matter of fact, Sam and I did a recording together, and I've been talking to L.C., Sam's brother, and they're trying to find it in the canyon. Trouble in the Land, and I sing a verse, and then Sam says, okay, Phelps, I got it, you know, and we switch off.
So it's like a duet with you and Sam Cooke?
Right. No, the Soulsters in the background.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was it, can you talk about a little bit, just because he's such a legendary singer, what it was like to work with Sam?
Sam was one of the warmest people that I have ever met. As a matter of fact, we talked to Sam 12 o'clock that night before his death.
So it must have been a shock when it happened.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, we was in Atlanta, Georgia, and our bus burned down to the ground, and we called Sam. And Sam says everything, which we said, man, our clothes, everything got burned up. Sam says, I'll get back to you guys first thing in the morning. And we never heard from him anymore.
That's crazy, yeah.
Yes.
So how long were you with the Soulsters?
I was with the Soulsters till 65, and the Chess Records, after Sam got killed, Chess Records nailed me right away. They say you're about the closest thing to Sam, so we'd like to give you a contract now.
Okay. But when you were with the Soulsters, how many years were you with them before you went solo?
I would say a year, yes.
And are you on any of the Soulsters recordings?
Yes.
Do you remember which records you were on?
Mother, Don't Worry About Me.
Okay.
And then I have four songs here that they recorded before, but I did a TV show, Jubilee Showcase, and, you know.
So did you do any other TV shows with the Soulsters?
Oh, yes. Throughout the country, I mean throughout the United States.
What types of TV shows were they?
Oh, my God. Atlanta, Georgia, I don't remember the name of the shows, but Atlanta, Georgia, New York, Miami, down through the, you know, hey.
Okay. Yeah, one thing I'm interested, too, is a lot of groups I talk to are more like R&B groups, so they appeared on, like, a lot of dance shows and, like, teen shows. But gospel groups wouldn't appear on the same shows, right?
Like, I'm sorry?
Gospel groups wouldn't appear on those same types of TV shows, right? You were on different TV shows?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, I was on Dick Clark's American Bandstand.
But when you were a solo artist, you were, right?
When I was with the Clefs of Calvary and after I was secular.
Okay, that's interesting. I never knew that they had gospel artists on those shows too.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go solo? You started talking about that.
I'm sorry.
You started talking about how you went solo before I asked more about the Soul Stirrers.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? How did Chess Records take you and make you a solo artist?
Well, Chess Records took me and I had a hit and. You know, Leonard Chess and I had, we came to some crossroads.
Okay, so who originally signed you to Chess? Was it Gene Barge?
Yes, Gene Barge.
And he actually wrote Love is a Five-Letter Word, right?
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, I did two or three songs on Chess that Gene Barge wrote. Action Speaks Louder Than Words, quite a few stops.
And how did Gene Barge find you and take you to Chess as a solo artist? What happened?
Well, Gene Barge was the A&R director. He was the assistant A&R director. Billy Davis was the director.
And how did he know you?
In the studio every day. I mean, he knew me from the Soul Stirrers.
Okay. And he just recognized your talent and decided to take you as a solo artist?
Right.
So, was there any animosity when you left the Soul Stirrers, or did they replace you right away with a different singer?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, we were at McCormick Place for the Sam Cooke Memorial. And I said to Folly, we were leaving for New York the next day, Muhammad Ali and all of us, we were leaving for New York the next day, and I told Folly, I said, I won't be making the trip with you guys. I said, because I won't do what Sam did. I said, Sam almost broke the group up. I said, I got a record that's coming out, R&B record that's coming out, and it'll be played by the time you guys get to New York. And sure enough, it was.
Okay. So you had already recorded the record, and you were just waiting for it to come out at that point?
Yes.
So you said you were going. They were going with Muhammad Ali to New York.
Well, Muhammad Ali was part of the Sam Cooke Memorial Show. We took the Sam Cooke Memorial Show to most of the cities around the United States.
Okay. I didn't know it was a whole memorial show. That's interesting.
Oh yes, Jerry. But we, as a matter of fact, we had two segments. We had gospel and the secular.
So you said Jerry Butler was on the review?
Oh, Jerry Butler, Johnny Taylor.
Yeah, that's interesting. So did you do any shows on the Sam Cooke review before you left to go solo?
Yes.
Okay. So you went solo, and Love is a Five-Letter Word. When you recorded it, did you think it would be a big hit right away, or was it surprising when it became a big hit?
Well, I was hoping Leonard Chess had all of the hope that I would be the next Sam Cooke. I said, "Well, I just want to be James Phelps, you know."
Okay, so when that record came out, did it get a lot of radio play right away? Did it take a while for it to hit?
It was number one. It was number one on the charts. On the Cashbox and Billboard, it was number one for 5 weeks.
So it was a pretty big hit.
Yes.
Do you remember if it got played on pop stations as well as R&B stations?
Yes, it did.
And so did you start touring as a solo artist at that point?
Yes, I did.
Where are some of the places that you went as a solo artist?
Well, I toured with the Supremes and Gladys Knight and the Pips and all. We had a 65-day tour, and from there, Little Milton and I worked together. Wilson Pickett, I made the circuit.
And did you have your own, so were you always part of other people's tours, or did you ever have your own band and review?
I had my own musician.
Okay. And what were your shows like? Like, did you just do Love is a Five-Letter Word? What other types of stuff did you do on the shows?
Well, we did a variety of things.
Okay. So your follow-up record was called La-Di-Da, I'm a Fool in Love.
Mm-hmm.
Did that get any play on the radio?
Yes, definitely. That was it was where Five-Letter Word was number one. It came on the chart, 95 with a bullet.
Okay. And then it was, so all your records, your first two records were released on a Chess subsidiary called Argo Records. And I know that Argo became Cadet Records, and your third record came out on Cadet. Is that right?
Right. Well, the Chess had to drop the label Argo, and that's where Cadet came in. And then I was with a subsidiary of Mercury after that.
Called Fontana Records?
Fontana, yes.
So how did you get with Fontana Records?
Gene Barge.
So why did you...
Gene Barge, because I had reached the crossroads at Chess, okay?
So they just weren't promoting you enough that you wanted, or something like that? So let me play... So you cut two records on Fontana. Let me play one of the records, and we can talk some more. Is that okay?
Okay, go ahead.
So this is a really nice track. I think it's from 1967. This is called Don't Be a Crybaby.
Okay.
Okay, that was just James Phelps with the first record he released on the Mercury subsidiary called Fontana Records. That was called Don't Be a Crybaby. And if you're just tuning in, I have James Phelps right now on the phone talking about his career. So he had left, we were just talking, James, about how you had left Chess Records to go to Fontana Records, and it was also through Gene Barge that you got to the label. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Was Gene also still working at Chess? Or had he,
yes.
So he just helped you get to the new label, but he was still working at Chess.
Right. As a matter of fact, Gene Barge helped me get do a tune on Paramount also. and they gave me a one-shot deal, and Otis Redding was my friend, so I wanted to do Otis Redding's old song in remembrance of Otis, My Lover's Prayer.
Okay. Yeah, so that was the last record you recorded, right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm still interested, though, in what was happening at Fontana Records. So that Don't Be a Crybaby track, it came out, I think, in 1967. And there's some backing singers on it. Do you remember who the backing singers were?
I don't know whether it was the Radians or the Dales. It was one of the two.
Okay. Yeah, that song had a really nice Chicago type of sound. Do you remember if it got played on the radio?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Got good airplay.
Okay. And you continued to tour and perform during that time?
Oh, yes. That's when everything started to fall apart.
Okay. Why were things falling apart at that time?
Well, I was asked to give up 50% of everything.
Okay, and then at two Fontana Records, you're saying?
And I refused to, and I had a new song coming out, Action, and Oh What a Feeling, and Cashbox at Billboard magazine had picked it for a two-sided hit, and I was told that I would hear it one time and I wouldn't hear it anymore, a good friend, Barry Folden, in Germany, sent me everything that I had made. Everything.
Okay, yeah, that was a nice gesture, too. So that record you were talking about, Cadet, that came out before the record I just played, right?
Yes.
So that was your last record on Chess. So you were saying the reason you left Chess was because they asked you to give up 50% of all your recordings.
And several other things that I don't care to, you know, elaborate on.
Okay, so that's why you went to Fontana Records then?
Yes, and then Fontana called me one day and told me that they would have to let me go because somebody is, he said I had some enemies out there, and they caught hell trying to get my record played. So they said they would have to let me go.
So, yeah, so Fontana had released one more record on you called The Wrong Number and Fabulous One, and you're saying you got sort of blackballed and couldn't get your record played.
Right.
So,
now, I did, also on Fontana, I did Ernest Tubbs' Old Walking the Floor Over You.
Yeah, that was the B-side of Don't Be a Crybaby, right?
Right.
Yeah, all those Fontana records are great. So you pretty much got airplay on the first record, and you said maybe the second one, the airplay got kind of killed off.
Right.
And, so were you still performing at that time?
Yes.
So what types of shows were you performing, mainly locally?
Oh, I was booked in Bermuda for, Christmas, and, I was booked for 6 months, and the phone started ringing saying that, the day that I was supposed to be there, the club would be closed for repairs and et cetera and et cetera.
So you're saying you actually got blackballed from performing in addition to getting your records played?
Oh, I know so.
Okay. So it wasn't until 4 years later, 1971, that you recorded again, and it was pretty much because you were having problems with the record labels. Is that right? So did you perform at all in between 1967 and 71?
Yes, very little though.
So you started on a non-music career at that time?
Well, no, I moved to California and, I became a businessman, you know, I had some government contracts, you know.
But that was after 72, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm talking about between 1967 and 1971. Was like 4 year period in your career where you had no records come out. Were you still performing at all in that period?
No.
So did you start working in Chicago at that time?
Right.
And in 1971, you recorded for the Apache record label. You did a track called You Were Made for Love and The Look on Your Face. So what happened? How did you get contacted by another record label? How did you get a chance to record again? What was the story with that?
Bobby Miller, I believe, was his name. Bobby Miller was the one that set me up with Apache.
Okay, and he was the guy who was the producer for the Dells, right?
Right.
And do you remember who ran Apache? I think Floyd Smith had something to do with it. Is that right?
No, I don't.
Okay. So you recorded this record. Both sides are really nice, and this is really big in the UK now, the look on your face. Let me play this track, and we could talk some more. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay, so this is James Phelps with a record he released in 1971 called The Look in Your Face. Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was a really nice record released by James Phelps called The Look on Your Face that came out on the Apache record label in 1971. There are only a few artists on the label. I think Loliata Holloway's first records are on that label. So, James, did that record get any play in Chicago?
Yes, it did.
Which side got play, the You Were Made for Love side or the Look on Your Face side?
You Were Made for Love.
Okay. So do you remember who sang backup on the record? There were some girls singing backup?
Etta James was on there with Sugar Patty Santo and Minnie Riperton.
Okay. And do you remember, was it recorded in Chicago too, that track, The Look on Your Face?
Oh, yes, it was.
Do you remember where it was recorded?
Matter of fact, it did Universal, I believe.
Okay. And so how come, so Apache only released that record, that one record, did the label fold soon after? Like, do you remember?
Because I moved to California, and I was kind of disgusted at that point.
But you had released one more record on Paramount Records, right?
Yes.
What was the story with that? How did you get onto Paramount Records?
The Paramount record, I wanted to do my lover's prayer in memory of Otis Redding. He and I was very good friends.
So had you done, you had previously done shows with Otis? Like, how did you know Otis?
Oh, yes, I toured with Otis quite a bit.
Okay, and so how did you get onto Paramount Records?
Gene Bart.
Okay, so they released My Lover's Prayer, backed with Check Yourself, in 1972, and that was also recorded in Chicago, is that right?
Yes.
Do you remember if that record got any play in Chicago?
Yes, it did. You know, I got good airplay. I mean, I can't complain. I got good airplay. Most of the stations played my stuff.
And you had said that you had problems getting shows before. Were you starting to do shows again?
I didn't have a problem getting. I was getting shows. I had a problem after I wasn't recording anymore.
Okay. So did you start to get shows again once you were recording in the early 70s?
Oh, yes.
And did you start touring nationally again, too?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And so what happened in 72? You were talking about moving to California. What year did you move to California?
Well, I moved to California, and I was in the glass business. I'm still in the glass business. I have a contract with the company, you know, with the government, you know.
And what year did you move to California? Did you move in 1972?
I moved to California in 72, yes.
And why did you decide to stop doing music?
Because I was doing so good with my business.
Okay. So did you start working in your business in Chicago and then move, or did you start up the business when you moved?
No, I started the business when I came to California.
So when you initially came to California, had you planned to do music?
Yes.
And so it just never happened because your business was so successful?
Well, I didn't pursue it.
Okay. So have you ever done any music since 1972?
No.
Okay. So do you still have your business now?
Yes.
Okay. So are you interested in doing any music now that it's been a while since people haven't heard your music?
As a matter of fact, I am very interested. It seems like all my fans are going to make me come out of retirement, and I definitely want to play the UK. And, you know, so, hey, I think I owe it to myself and owe it to my fans. If they want to hear me, I'm ready to rock and roll.
Yeah, that would be awesome if you're doing shows again. I'm sure people will be really excited to see you perform. So if people want to get in contact with you to do shows in the UK, what should they do? Do you have a website or an email address?
Well, they could get in touch with Michael Hockridge. They can get in touch with Michael Hockridge at area code 510-444-1899.
Okay.
9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific time.
Okay, well, I'll definitely spread the word, too, and if I hear anything, I'll definitely, you know, pass the word on. Hopefully you can do some shows over there. And are you ever planning to record again, too?
I'm sorry?
Are you ever planning to record again also?
As a matter of fact, yes, I do plan on recording. I have some good material here.
So you've been continuously writing even though you haven't been recording?
Yes. And then I could always count on Gene Barge. The last time I talked to Gene asked me if I was ready.
He's a great guy.
Yes, he is.
Okay, well, thanks so much, first of all, for telling your story. You have a very interesting story and an interesting piece of Chicago soul music history. One thing I forgot to ask you is, didn't you have a sister that recorded also?
Did I have what?
Did you have a sister that recorded also?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Did you have any relatives that also recorded besides you?
Oh, yes, my sister, Joyce Davis.
Okay, yeah, because a lot of people, like, she had some hits in Chicago, but a lot of people don't know that she's your sister.
Right, she had some hits in Chicago.
Okay, well, thanks so much for telling your story. I really appreciate it.
Okay, please mention the fact that I'd like to say hello to Michael Hockridge's kids, Taylor, and to my kids and grandkids, And from the golden shores of Southern Cal, I'd like to say hello to all of my fans across the country.
Okay, thanks again, and I'm sure everybody loves your music and appreciates everything you've done.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Okay, have a good night.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, that was just James Phelps telling the story of his records. This last record I'm going to play by him is the other side of his Apache record from 1971. This is called You Were Made for Love. And if you want to call up to pledge, you have 20 minutes left. The number is 773-702-8424.